Joining us on the program is Professor David Lowe, who's the director of the Alfred Deakin Research Institute. Hello, David.
G'day, Trevor. How are you going?
Good. We're going to talk this morning about Sir Robert Menzies. You're the author of a book of Robert Menzies as well, and the Great World Struggle. Let's talk about Menzies himself and his childhood. What sort of a childhood did he have?
Well, he had a childhood that was based in Western Victoria, in the small town of Jeparit in the Wimmera area. And he had parents who were very ambitious on his behalf. They weren't wealthy, but they believed in a mixture of self-education through reading the right books, and had a decent library in the house. But they're also ambitious to the extent of making sure that young Bob got to decent schools, a couple of schools in Ballarat, where he went from strength to strength. So ended up getting a scholarship to a college that was a private school, Grenville College at the time, and from there to Wesley, and on to the University of Melbourne. So, in a reasonably humble circumstances, shopkeeper parents, but ones that had a great sense of thrift and enterprise. His dad was also a member of the Victorian Legislative Assembly. So mixture of politics, ambition, and kind of frugality, I guess.
Was he expected to work as well? Did he work hard?
He did. He was one of those who was clearly gifted, and that was demonstrated by his school results. But he also had a great sense of enterprise and endeavour to everything he did. He read voraciously, and he threw himself into everything too. So at Melbourne Uni, he didn't just get tremendous marks on his way to becoming a lawyer, getting a law degree, but he also threw himself into things such as the president of the Student Union Council and editor of the Melbourne Uni magazine at the time. So yes, he was very active.
Was his politics always to the right? I mean, this is pre-Liberal Party.
Yeah, look, Liberal Party, of course, doesn't come into existence, the modern-day Liberal Party, of course, that is, doesn't come into existence until the mid-40s. Those principles and those kind of ethos qualities that I was talking about of hard work and thrift and the Scottish background, they probably always lent towards the right in terms of the parental and the schooling upbringing. It's not until later in his career at Melbourne University that he becomes outspoken and starts to exhibit principles that we'd normally associate with the right side, and then as a growing and successful lawyer around the early 1920s, you can see signs of it as well.
When we associate, and this is more to do with the societal thing, but back in that time in universities and politics, was there a general move to the right in universities then in comparison to now, which there's an association with the left in politics, in as far as political views in universities?
Yeah, well, I suspect your last comment might have to be modified a bit. I think there's been something of a correction, back towards the centre or occasionally even the right in
okay.
more recent years. But generally, yes, partly by definition of who is attending universities. It just didn't have the breadth of base that we associate with, say, 1970s onward.
Mm-hmm.
And by definition, the constituency going to universities, of course, a smaller number in the first half of the century, tended to be from, the wealthier side of society and tended to, therefore, exhibit tendencies towards the more conservative end of politics.
And then when we saw a more openness and free university, that we started to see that change a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. In general terms, I'd agree, yeah.
Hmm. But that's completely got nothing to do with it. From university, what was the step into politics?
He was mobilised by a couple of people in Victoria who were dissatisfied with the way in which the conservative side of politics was travelling. So first of all, the entrance is into Victorian politics in 1928, briefly a member of the Legislative Council, the upper house, and then shifting to the lower house the next year. He achieved cabinet rank in Victoria by becoming Attorney General in 1932. And at that stage, he's starting to get this reputation as one of the young Nats, one of the young Nationals, this new group of Nationals who are a little bit fed up with the older structures of the party. This is the National Party, the main Conservative Party at the time. So being one of the younger ones meant that he was one of those who was a bit dissatisfied with the big business side of things, big business running the party. There was the notion that Collins Street basically ran the party in those days, and was, you know, therefore restless and wanting reform and change and more younger members to come up through the ranks. So it's Victorian politics initially. Then also in the early 1930s, he gets involved in the more federal move to persuade Joe Lyons to abandon the ALP, abandon the Labor Party, and set up in this new United Australia Party, so the big Lyons defection in the early 1930s. Menzies is one of those who encourages him. Finally, he himself hits federal politics and that well-known seat of Kooyong in 1934, and from there he just goes from strength to strength.
Was it his upbringing in small business that was promoting that, recognising that it's small business that drives Australia?
To some extent, yes. I mean, I think you can see a really strong thread from those kind of values of thrift and the parental and early educational influences through this time, and even into the early to mid 1940s, when he, he's prime minister and then deposed and rebuilding what becomes the Liberal Party. You can see a rhetoric throughout all of this time, which is concerned with, well, the phrase that people probably know best is the forgotten people, in this famous speech of 1942 that's often recalled. The forgotten people are precisely that. They're the small business owners, the small artisans. They're those who aren't either catered for by the big, powerful trade union movement on the one hand, or the big end of town, big business on the other. They're all those in between. So, yeah, I think that's a common thread throughout his career, and he increasingly deploys that rhetoric and uses it for persuasive effect with voters incredibly successfully as his career goes on.
You were saying that he was fighting against the established sort of politics of that time to the right. Did that oppress him at all, or were there enough people supporting him to keep him moving?
It certainly got him into some fights in Victoria, and some generational fights too. As I mentioned, that tag of young Nats, young Nationals, meant that he was, deliberately identifying himself as one of the younger ones. But he had a lot of supporters. He had people around him who were of similar mind. And gradually, as we go into the, late 1930s and the outbreak of World War II, you get to see increasingly a younger set accumulating in New South Wales, likes of Percy Spender and others, who were of a similar mind in terms of their agitation for change, their realisation that conservative politics up to that stage had been maybe too beholden to big business and maybe just too negative, full stop. Maybe just saying, we do what the Labor Party doesn't do, rather than having a very proactive, forward-looking policy. So the stars start to align for Menzies in particular in the late 1930s with a number of other like-minded people entering federal politics.
So is he moving a little bit to the left?
Look, to some extent, yes. I think the shift comes with the war and, as I said before, Menzies is deposed and has to leave in great ignominy and terrible circumstances in 1941. But soon after that, as he's rebuilding his own kind of fortunes and starting to think about what might be a new party, he and certain think tanks, this is the formation of the IPA, the Institute of Public Affairs, in various states, and several branches, the Victorian one in particular, seems to assist Menzies in sort of reconciling those dearly held liberal values of individualism and the sanctity of individual freedom of rights and so on, with the new thing of Keynesianism, of more centralised planning, of a bigger government, of the world after World War II needing more planning, more robust central government. That kind of reconciliation between old conservative notions of liberalism and the brave new world that's a bit more Keynesian, involves a few more bureaucrats and a bigger role for Canberra. Menzies actually embraces that kind of, rhetoric which melds these two streams of thought. And that really sets him off on a path that's slightly different from some of the more old-fashioned conservatives.
If you'd like to join us, 1-300-800-222, text 0437 774 774 as we talk about Robert Menzies on the program this morning. Hello, Phil.
How are you going? I just wanted to ask, had Menzies remained Prime Minister when Singapore fell, what do you think the ramifications would have been? What would he have done?
Look, good question. I suspect there would have been a lot of continuity to the extent that some of the biggest factors influencing the fate of Australia were beyond Australia's control. As we know, the fall of Singapore was a tremendous shock, a shock to Australia, but a shock generally. But the extent to which the British and the Americans had already sort of agreed on the beat Hitler first policy and to therefore fight a holding war in the Pacific, just try to maintain something of a bridge, which of course was constituted through the Battle of Midway, the Battle of Coral Sea, those turning points in Papua New Guinea, those kind of contours of war would have played out similarly. I suspect on the home front, Menzies would have, not to the same extent, but he probably would have ramped up the ways in which Canberra marshalled forces and ran people's lives with rationing and so on, to some extent in a similar way to John Curtin. I suspect there probably would have been probably less centralised control, probably not to the same extent as Curtin, but I think the general direction probably would have been similar. That's my hunch.
He's a heck of a lot more supportive of the British Empire. Would he have brought the troops back?
Yeah, look, people tend to forget that Menzies was really reluctant to send that first contingent of forces to the Middle East when the Second World War broke out. He was amongst those who were terrified about what they regarded as the inadequate defences of Singapore and was forever pressing the Brits on, what are you going to do if? Now, the fact that he didn't succeed, doesn't detract from the fact that he was terribly worried, had particularly Australian perspectives in mind, and, didn't get much further than any of his predecessors had done. So I'm not sure that Menzies can be really accused of, obeying British dictates in the war in ways that were peculiarly, beholden to a certain Anglo-centrism. You're quite right to say that, for Menzies, the British world was the centre of his way of perceiving international affairs. He had this kind of organic notion of empire of which Australia was a part. But in wartime circumstances, it was him who said, what Britain calls the Far East is to us the Near North in 1940. He did have some pretty distinct views and was pretty hard-headed. He had some big clashes with Churchill when he went and so on.
Let's talk about how it is that he had two terms in Parliament.
Well, Menzies fell in disgrace in August 1941. This is after being elected after the death of Joe Lyons. In August 1941, he'd come back from elected as Prime Minister in April 1939. He was in Europe, mostly in London, for the first 4 months of 1941, trying hard to get some of those assurances about Singapore, trying hard to get more of an Australian voice consistently and consistently in the British War Cabinet, not with great success, but no one else did either. And he knew before he left that his political position was incredibly fragile. He was, after the September 1940 elections, he was dependent on the votes of just two independents. Bit of an echo with more recent times in Australian politics, of course. But it was reasonably commonplace for Australian prime ministers in a time of crisis to think that their stocks would actually be boosted by going overseas and going to London and talking up the Australian interests and so on and then coming back. So it wasn't completely rash thing to go and spend the first 4 months of the year in London. But it didn't work. He didn't get those big successes. And while he was away, there were lots of intrigues. Menzies at that stage was renowned for not suffering fools gladly, not building enough allies around him, not having enough people to watch his back. So there were all sorts of intrigues while he was away, and he had to fall on his sword in August 1941. He comes back into the picture, of course, at the end of the 1940s after that long period of Labor rule under later leadership under John Curtin first and then Ben Chifley after that.
Was it a disillusionment in the Labor Party that saw him re-elected, or were there policies that people wanted to see achieved by Menzies?
I think there's a bit of both. I mean, by the time we get to the second half of the 1940s, Ben Chifley is taking some very bold, Sir Humphrey would say courageous strides, in the sense of trying to nationalise the banks, struggling with unions over coal strikes in particular in 1949, which meant repeated blackouts throughout Australia, and struggling to curb the rise of communist influence in the Union. At the same time, the Cold War is deepening. By the time we get to 1947-48, the sense of crisis in world affairs, the sense even in countries under Labour rule, such as Attlee's Britain, was such that they were taking hard lines on unions. They were really trying to put the clamp down on communist influence wherever they saw it. This was something that Menzies successfully seized on in his newly constituted Liberal Party. And so it's a combination of chiefly perhaps overreaching with some of his attempts to bring the country with him in a brave new world, and centralised reforms with an even stronger role for Canberra, versus Menzies harnessing some of that forgotten people rhetoric that I was talking about before, and also building on the communist threat. Those in really general terms seem to be factors that propelled him back to power.
Joining us this morning is Professor David Lowe, Director at the Alfred Deakin Research Institute and author of Menzies and the Great World Struggle, Australia's Cold War 1948 to 1954. Is this a time of really big change? Because there are some important decisions being made there, especially things like the White Australia policy.
Yeah, look, I argue in the book that it is quite an unusual and distinctive period. Basically, at the heart of my argument is that Menzies actually genuinely believed that the Third World War was coming. This was a period of heightened tension all around the world. He visited Berlin in 1948, just before becoming PM, and was seized of just how dire the situation was. And Washington and London said similarly right through the early to mid-1950. So Menzies reacted accordingly. He tried to set up something of a national security state. We know that he tried to ban the Communist Party. He actually started stockpiling. He introduced national service, et cetera, et cetera. All sorts of things. Now, the Third World War didn't come, thank goodness, and some of his efforts didn't really work. The Australian economy became overheated and he had to back down from some of this. But the important thing to note is that, at that time, Menzies was quite genuine, I think, in his fears of the threat of international communism, the Soviets had the bomb and so on. So subsequent arguments about Menzies kicking the communist can just in order for political advantage and to make life uncomfortable for the Labor Party, I think is misplaced. He certainly did that. I mean, he certainly was very adept at making life hard for the Labor Party and by maximising the dangers of communism in ways that hurt the Labor Party. But in the early 50s, at least, I think he was also genuinely scared. As for the White Australia policy, yes, look, that was still very intact. And it only progressively started to be dismantled in the second half of the 1960s, really post-Menzies. Mm. But at the same time, one of the reasons why things became overheated is because Menzies is embarking on the kind of huge projects of national development, the Snowy Mountains scheme continuing, great waves of immigration. So he's embarking on this kind of huge national development agenda too, which goes hand in hand with what's remembered as the more negative side of things, the White Australia, the more exclusive side of things for Australia.
We started to hear through the former Prime Ministers the recognition of the US and the importance of a relationship there and possibly moving away from Britain. Did he still see the importance of that relationship?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think he wanted to move away from Britain, if at all possible, but there's no doubt that he was very realistic and hard-headed about the importance of the US. It's partly from just, recognising how battered Britain was after World War II, how spent it was. It's partly from recognising the importance of the US in anything relating to the Pacific, the future of the Pacific, and of course we get the ANZUS Treaty in 1951. Even though probably the person who leads that negotiation and that energy is Percy Spender, his foreign minister, Menzies is very quick to pick up on that and make it good. And he standardises the Australian military equipment with the Americans in 1957. Now, he still hoped that there'd be a very active role and Britain wouldn't withdraw its bases east of Suez for a long time, and was very disappointed when they signalled they had to. The greatest disappointment probably comes from Britain's attempts to join the European community in the early 60s. That's when the Australians, all of them really, get quite a shock about what that means for affiliation and trade and identity, indeed. So, yes, it's a very gradual story. It's not a fast one. I don't buy the line that, you know, World War II comes along and Australia just suddenly shifts to the US. It doesn't happen like that at all. Mm. It's very gradual. It's probably, you know, more the early 60s. And Menzies bemoaned it, basically. At one stage he said, "I fear I am out of step with the melancholy march of events." And that was a typically, you know, colourful phrase to describe that it actually hurt him. He was pained by this.
Pat joins us. Hello, Pat.
Hello. I was a very young schoolgirl in World War II, but I can remember my father talking about a Brisbane line, and what he said was pretty scary. I was just wondering if he could explain it to me, whether my memory is correct or not.
Yes, indeed. It's a good memory. Yes, Menzies suffered from the criticism after he lost power in 1941. He suffered from the criticism that Labor government members levelled at him of having prepared plans to, in the event of an invasion from the Japanese, of having prepared plans to draw a kind of defensive line called the Brisbane Line, which ran from Brisbane and then kind of cut a diagonal corner towards Adelaide across that, you know, that southeast part of Australia. Now, and he was pilloried about this by Labor opponents. There's a bit of truth to it in the sense that Australian Defence Forces did, you know, engage in some contingency scenario planning for possibly doing this. But I think it was, you know, exaggerated and used for political effect. I mean, this is the job of Defence Forces. They're meant to do these things. They're meant to plan, you know, what if. And so such plans did exist. But there's no evidence to suggest that Menzies was, you know, hell-bent on drawing such a line if and when invasions came. It's just that the Brisbane line became a very, very politicised issue.
Oh, so basically he was saying that, OK, if this happens, we'll at least save this little pocket of Australia and they can have the rest.
Well, sort of, but as I say, it was really just, it was only really a document that existed at Defence Forces planning level. There's no evidence that at a government level they'd made any decision to, in fact, deploy the Brisbane line.
Doug, good morning. Oh, Doug's gone away. He wanted to say that Menzies was a cricket lover.
Oh, yes, very much. Yeah, absolutely. Loved going to matches whenever he could over here in England, where I'm currently based. And, of course, you know, formed significant friendships with Australian cricketers. Lindsay Hassett and others were often seen talking to Menzies.
Did he play himself? Was he a sports person himself, especially in younger years?
No, look, I don't get that sense. I don't think there's a tremendous degree of athleticism in Menzies' background. It certainly doesn't come out in school records and so on. So I think it's a love that, you know, he takes on at more cerebral and emotional levels early on.
Someone said that he introduced the dry zones in Victoria, in the leafy suburbs. Do you know about that?
That's a good question. Yeah, look, I'm not sure on that score. I mean, the timing of it could be right. I can't remember off the top of my head when the dry zones were introduced. I don't think, you know, Menzies was terribly prudish, though, generally. He enjoyed whiskies at the end of long weeks in Parliament and was, you know, had a great sense of bonhomie over a drink at the end of long sessions and so on. So it could well be. I'm not sure on that score, but I'm not also suggesting that he was a prude in any way that, or in terms of alcohol.
I've got a text here about asking about the term pig iron Bob.
Yeah, again, a criticism that Labor opponents deployed to pretty good effect. Just before he became Prime Minister, he oversaw a shipment of pig iron to Japan, and of course was subject to the criticism that this iron could be coming back at us in the form of bullets and shells. It was a decision that was really taken by, you know, Minister for Trade, and Menzies only, as Attorney General, was responsible for endorsing it legally. So again, it's a little bit harsh, but nevertheless, there was a shipment. It wasn't a kind of succession of shipments, but there was significant one shipment that went to Japan for reasons which, you know, had been decided in the party, and so therefore, by defending it very publicly, Menzies was stuck with this epithet of pig iron Bob by his opponents.
Tom, good morning.
I remember shaking Bob Menzies' hand as a Cub Scout in Matawa, Victoria.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if that was an introduction of decimal currency, and I'm wondering if that affects Australia's policy as to promoting banking in Australia at the moment.
Yeah, so how important and how well thought out and the reasons behind the move to decimalisation and decimal currency, David?
I think the writing was on the wall, and I've mentioned a couple of things here, Britain's decision to join the European community, but also the increasing move, by the time we get to the 1960s, increasing signs that the gold standard is giving way to, you know, a dollar-led world. So whilst it can look like it's, you know, an Australian initiative that is, you know, slightly more independent and so on, I think it's also very cognizant of trends in international finance more broadly. So in that sense, it's a realistic response as much as a local initiative. Interestingly, of course, we know that Menzies was keen, that there was a bit of a competition, and people may remember that there was a lot of suggested names for the new currency. And there's some pretty interesting ones like Kanga and Emu and all sorts of interesting things. Menzies himself preferred the term the Royal. it didn't last long, although I think the Mint toyed with that, brought out some, you know, some mock dollars and so they were called rather than dollars, called Royals. But before those plans went too far, common sense prevailed, and the dollar and cents formula was introduced. But yeah, I'm sure that there were many people who met Menzies around that time, because it required quite a lot of information. There was a big campaign on how people had to adjust their lives and forget about pounds and pence and move to dollars and cents.
Bob, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, Bob.
Going back in the car history, Hartnett worked for General Motors developing the Holden car. He left Holden and went to build the Hartnett car, a small car for the family, with advanced engineering and design. The benefits that were given to General Motors to develop the Australian car were denied to Hartnett, and under a number of years, Hartnett was destroyed by Menzies.
And you're saying that he wasn't supportive of local industry?
He wasn't supportive of the car industry, of building a truly Australian car.
David?
Now, look, it's an interesting story. I don't know the details of that one, but thanks, Bob. I think that's really interesting. Menzies, I've mentioned that term national development, and the other term that's sometimes used is Australia Unlimited. And that phrase was also meant to signal that, you know, Australia was open for business to those corporations, including overseas corporations, who wanted to invest in Australia. So to that extent, yeah, there was also always going to be some tensions between Australian-made products and the big foreign companies. So, you know, the Hartnett story doesn't altogether surprise me. It's, I suspect there'll be other stories we could find where, you know, really enterprising local businesses suffered during this period. But in the context of, you know, reforms and the opening up of the Australian economy we've seen from late 1970s onward, I guess, you know, it's a small version of what's become, you know, far more rampant in over the last 30 years. Mm.
I would like comments on being a good Tasmanian. Dame Edith Glyans' attitude towards Menzies. I know she liked Chifley. She reckoned he was a gentleman. And in all fairness, Bob Menzies was a pallbearer at Chifley's funeral. Mm. But she didn't like Menzies in the slightest.
No. This remains one of the great mysteries of Australian politics. I mentioned before, when Menzies was overseas, mostly in Britain, in the first half of 1941, there were all sorts of intrigues to unseat him, all sorts of rumours swirling as to people being unhappy. And at that time, it became clear that Dame Edith wasn't happy with Menzies. She and others thought and continued to think that Menzies was one of those who made Joe Lyons' life very tough towards the end of his prime ministership, and of course his life. He died, as we know, tragically from heart problems. And some never forgave Menzies there was a crucial vote on a national insurance bill where Menzies departed from Lyons. and that seemed to be one of the triggers for Lyons' ailing health. So Dame Enid, you know, was one of those who was probably a Menzies detractor. Now, again, it's a little bit hard, and Menzies' official biographer, Alan Martin, doesn't really buy into the notion that Menzies went out of his way to topple Lyons, went out of his way to make life hard for him. But there's no doubt that Menzies' actions around that time, not just Menzies' actions of others as well, made life more difficult for Joe Lyons, whose health was already failing. So in that sense, it's pretty understandable that Dame Enid found it hard to forgive Menzies.
Ian?
Yeah, I went to this election speech in the Unley Hall in 1961, I think it was, could have been 62, and Sir Robert Menzies was a champion at repartee, and this student bloke got up, started to heckle him in the hall, and Sir Robert used his, shall we say, command of the language to make this chap look a real fool.
Thank you, Ian. Recognised as a great speaker as well, David.
Oh, indeed. There are legendary stories, and those who, you know, were lucky enough to hear him in action probably got, you know, lots of interesting memories. Even those who, for, you know, side of politics or other reasons, couldn't stand Bob Menzies, rarely failed to be impressed by, you know, the power of his speech and the power to deal with interjectors. I mean, one classic one that's sometimes recalled, either talking to a heckler or maybe even directed towards a party colleague at one stage. The story goes that someone says to him, "The trouble with you, Bob, is you don't suffer fools gladly." And Bob replies, "I don't know, what do you think I'm doing right now?"
Haven't we lost that in politics?
I agree. It is one feature that's always very interesting and very entertaining. And it evokes an era in which the kind of cut and thrust and the capacity to speak on the hustings really inculcated certain characteristics in politicians. Menzies didn't like TV for that reason, because it was all set piece. He said at one stage that he was allergic to television because there was too little sense of interaction with the audience. So you can see that he was a creature of an earlier time in that sense.
Cecil, good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
Yes, Cecil.
I'd just like to talk about a couple of military matters with Bob Menzies. First, about the Vietnam War, how we got involved in the Vietnam War, because it's been pretty well recorded at times where Menzies told Parliament that the South of Vietnamese government asked for military aid in their battle with the communist North. And that wasn't so. That was an absolute, you know, not right, you know. He's done that to appease the Americans.
Cecil, I've got 5 minutes to go and a few things, and the Vietnam War was an important thing I wanted to bring up. Why is it that we were involved in Vietnam, and why did Menzies get us involved?
Yeah, look, really briefly, I think that's absolutely right, that depiction. The invitation from the South Vietnamese government was engineered. The Australians were already angling to commit some forces in line with American wishes. The picture is a bigger one, though, than just South Vietnam. The Australians were keen to do anything at that stage in the mid-1960s to maintain an American presence somewhere, anywhere in Southeast Asia, because the fear was not just South Vietnam. The fear was a very unstable, potentially going communist Indonesia. This was before the great coup in Indonesia wiped out the Communist Party. So, yes, that's absolutely accurate, but it's not just Vietnam that prompts, it's not just the situation in Vietnam that prompts this enthusiasm, including a rather bogus offer from the South Vietnam government. It's the idea that if we could do something by showing our support as a good ally that would maintain an American physical presence somewhere in Southeast Asia, that might be a jolly good thing at a time when anything, and in particular Indonesia, on our doorstep looks incredibly unstable.
What did the community think of this time of conscription?
Actually, at the time, there was a lot of popularity for national service. It was an extremely popular thing. Now, that sounds funny in today's climate, but, you know, the idea of rigour for 18-year-olds and some compulsory training and the notion that the citizen soldier, you know, the people on the streets could be mobilised for Australia's defence, was still pretty strongly held in the Australian community to about this time. Now, of course, things turned sour reasonably quickly by the late 1960s. And we tend to forget that when conscription was introduced, national service was introduced, it was with Indonesia in mind. Now, very quickly, the Vietnam War trumps that as an issue and becomes a site. But going back to my earlier comments, it was national service for confrontation with Indonesia and Malaysia that spurred the actual initiative.
Was it the Vietnam War was one of the contributing factors into the downfall of Menzies?
No, I don't think so. It certainly, you see, Menzies retires before, you know, the legacies of Vietnam really come home to roost. He retires early in 66. It's only in the late 60s and those tremendous shocks that we get by Nixon announcing in 1969 that we're winding back in Vietnam, the Australians finding out about this all too late, and then Nixon declaring that we're not going into Southeast Asia again without significant Allied support. This catches Menzies' successors, first Harold Holt and then Bolte, Harold Holt and other successors by great surprise. Billy McMahon is the person I'm trying to think of. So Menzies himself is removed from the situation.
They were about a minute and a half away from the news. How would you describe or summarise his prime ministership?
Oh, look, it's extraordinary for its longevity. That period of 16 years, you know, is, as we know, unparalleled. And he's fortunate to preside over a time of the so-called long boom, tremendous growth and prosperity in most Western democracies, and Australia's very much a part of that. Yes, the Cold War's raging, but it doesn't prevent Menzies from presiding over a great period of national development, this great period of immigration. We have about 2 million new Australians arriving by the mid-1960s, from the end of the war to the mid-1960s. In that sense, he's fortunate, but he also, he can boast some achievements. He'll always be criticised. I think he'll always remain one of those figures who can be easily politicised and, as Paul Keating loved to do, made into a kind of caricature of pro-British and out of date and so on. But there is what most Australians would regard as steady progress in all sorts of social, economic, educational and other ways during this period.
David, it's been a pleasure talking to you this morning. Thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure, Trevor.
Professor David Lowe, Director of the Alfred Deakin Research Institute.